a pause, but no peace. The fragile ceasefire in Iran is threatened by escalating threats and accusations. Coming up, we're speaking with local community leaders and activists about how the impacts of what's happening in Iran and the Middle East are being felt here. It's Thursday, April 9th, 2026. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. The U.S. and Israel launched joint strikes against Iran February 28th that killed the Middle Eastern country's supreme leader, Ayatollah. The next day, I met Pooyan Baluchian in downtown Orlando, where Iranian Americans gathered to celebrate the possible end of the regime. He's the former president of the Iranian American Community Center of Central Florida, an organizer of the event where dozens chanted and danced to show appreciation for a moment many waited decades to see. Baluchian estimates 7,000 Iranians live in Central Florida. A lot has happened in the last 40 days since the start of the war in Iran. Central Floridians have been following a roller coaster, high-stakes week. Yesterday, Iran said the ceasefire is unreasonable. The day before, President Trump threatened to blow up infrastructure in Iran and warned a whole civilization would die if his demands and deadlines weren't met. Baluchian says the killing of Ayatollah was a turning point.
That got people extremely excited about the fact that after 47 years of pure repression and oppression, finally people were able to breathe a sign of relief, knowing that this big dictator is no longer in power.
Have you seen the change that you were really hoping for?
Well, we are still in the middle of this rescue operation, obviously. Therefore, we are not oblivious of the fact that we need to keep going. We need to verbalize what the people of Iran want, which is a total collapse of this regime. I have heard in the news in the past 24 hours that, you know, there has been a regime change of some sort. That is absolutely not what the people of Iran see, because the son of the late so-called supreme leader, essentially, is in power. We don't know, in fact, if he's alive or not. We have not seen him on camera. We have not heard his voice, nothing. There are reports that he is, in fact, dead, and they are not just announcing it. So the son of the late supreme leader being in power, how can we ever associate that to a regime change? A regime change is the total collapse of this regime. And then for the crown prince, Reza Pahlavi, to lead the transition into a democratic government by means of the vote of the people of Iran. That is what the people of Iran consider as regime change, not anywhere close to what we're observing right now could be considered regime change.
What is the path forward to that change you want to see?
So obviously there are multiple dimensions that need to be taken into serious consideration here. One is the fact that the Iranian people are not armed. And no matter how many times they have taken it to the streets to essentially chant for freedom, this dictator regime has killed them in big numbers. Therefore, what that screams is that we need a military intervention in the country to help the people with this transition. And that is exactly what started happening by the joint effort of Israel and America. And the people currently in Iran, and I have many relatives in Iran, I've got many friends in Iran with whom we are in daily contact, they only have one fear and one fear only. And that is this war, or the way we call it, this rescue mission, to end and stop with this regime still in power. They are not fearing the bombs. They are not fearing the war. They have one fear, and that fear is limited to this war stopping with this regime still in power.
Before the ceasefire, President Trump warned a whole civilization will die and threatened to blow up bridges and power plants in Iran. What was your reaction to hearing that?
That is a very good question. So, in fact, the point that I would like to talk about here is that if the life of this regime, the existing dictator regime, is tied to the existence of power plants and bridges, the people of Iran have already verbalized that they do not want that infrastructure to be in place if the existence of that infrastructure is tied to continuation of this dictatorship for years ahead.
Are you saying that people in Iran that you know that you're speaking about are willing to die over this?
Well, if I had the opportunity for you to share my screen and go over stories coming out of Iran that the news outlets are not really covering, where they are crying and they're like, we would like to sacrifice our lives, just like the life of the 40,000 innocent people. If that is going to put an end to this regime, we are willing to sacrifice our lives so that this dictatorship can eventually collapse. And I know that that is something that is unheard of, something that you don't actually see very often when situations like this unfold in different countries. But we're talking about 47 years of genocide, of massacre on so many different levels in that country. So to put a little bit of context around this, Iran has access to a lot of oil. Where has the money gone to, though? The money, not even a penny, has gone to the pocket of the ordinary people in this country. So the infrastructure that leads into the export of oil is not something people are sensitive about because they are already not being benefited from that infrastructure. So why should we treat that infrastructure as something that the people are worried about when in fact people are not even benefiting from it?
This impacts you personally. When I talked to you after this began at the end of February, you were very appreciative of President Trump. Are you still in support of the president?
Even if the war ends today, even though today's outcome, if we leave it halfway through, is not completely satisfying the real want of the Iranian people, because of the services that President Trump has rendered for the Iranian people, the Iranian people are always appreciative and have nothing but gratitude for President Trump for what he has done so far.
Puyan Baluchian is the former president of the Iranian American Community Center of Central Florida. For some, this week has underscored the need for diplomacy and de-escalation. Representative Anna Eskamani says she is in constant communication with other Iranian American elected officials across the country and in Central Florida, and she is trying to stay in touch with family in Iran. The Democrat from Orlando is critical of the president's rhetoric this week.
I would say the two-week ceasefire is a relief. The fact that there was a countdown to, quote, destroying a civilization was just one of the most appalling and unhinged announcements I've ever seen from President Trump, which is saying a lot, because there's a pattern of just, you know, these spontaneous announcements on social media. And so a lot of us were bracing for impact because it's just so hard to know what he means. So a lot of uncertainty, but seeing a pause, it's hopeful in the sense that more innocent people will not die and our service members will be protected. I do think it's worth noting that commentary from Iran oftentimes is also centered on a concern that these weeks of war and weeks of destruction and violence will yield to nothing different in Iran. And that's a very valid concern, because obviously one of the reasons why President Trump started this war with Israel was for, quote, regime change.
That language you talked about before the ceasefire, hearing the president warning that a whole civilization will die and threatening to blow up the infrastructure, bridges, and power plants. What did that feel like for you to hear?
When I see that type of rhetoric, it angers me, because those are war crimes. What he is professing is against the Geneva Convention. It is a clear red line in the sand. But it also reminds me of why we do this work, of why we have to be brave enough to challenge that rhetoric and not normalize violence. This is not a video game. This is not a sporting activity. And we're talking about life and death situations. And we're talking about U.S. tax dollars being spent to destroy not just infrastructure, but people's lives across the world. And that is such a grave responsibility that our elected officials like myself have. And it's really important to be thoughtful, intentional, and careful with how you use that power. And I just feel like that commentary was so irresponsible and so unhinged. And it's embarrassing in the context of how the United States is showing up on a national stage.
The friends and the family that you're thinking about in Iran, are you even able to get in touch with them right now?
It's a really great question. I'm actually going to check my WhatsApp for this morning to see. And the last message that I saw from one of my cousins was on March 31st. And it's an expression of hope. All of us hope these days will end with our freedom. And that's the type of resilience and just hope that the people of Iran have. I mean, it speaks to just how beautiful the everyday Iranian is in experiencing bombs from the sky, internet crackdowns, and still holding on to hope. It's so incredibly brave and heartbreaking at the same time. But because of the regime and their oppressive nature and their threats to those who protest and their public executions, and their internet shutdown, that's the last message that I have for my loved one.
As we're sitting here talking, do you know if they're okay?
I have no idea. You can only hope that no news is good news. I have family across Iran, and I've not been able to talk to every person at all. So you just hope that everything's going to be fine.
Where do we go from here? What's next?
I wish I had a clear answer for that. You know, I think what we can do as just good Samaritans is to continue to be the voice for the people in Iran. You know, oftentimes we uplift pundits and political talking heads and influencers that are here in the United States or outside of Iran. There are so many organizations like the Center for Human Rights in Iran that focus their advocacy and their storytelling on those in Iran. We do need to uplift those that have been fighting for freedom in Iran under the banner of self-determination. And they need us more than ever to uplift their voices and their demands. And I'm hopeful that if we are approaching a long-term peace negotiation, that the confines of that deal includes freeing all political prisoners in Iran, includes a pathway for a democratic Iran, includes women not being forced to engage in mandatory hijab. There's many opportunities at this point to at least try to ensure that the regime is not going to be more oppressive than before.
For people here in Central Florida who maybe don't feel so connected to what's happening, what is it that you would like people to just understand about what's happening in Iran?
There is not one person, especially not one Iranian, that can really speak on behalf of the entire diaspora. It's very, very split. And this is, of course, connected to just decades of trauma inflicted by the Islamic Republic of Iran, by a feeling that there is no other path but war, a feeling that this is not war, this is a rescue mission. I mean, these are some of the conversations that are taking place within the diaspora. With that said, we need to be focused on the health and safety in the future of the people of Iran, and they need to be the ones to decide that future, not foreign governments. And to assume that every person in Iran is anti-regime would also be naive. And that's the nuance and the complications of this moment. And I also am very concerned about the fact that the Islamic Republic of Iran does not care about the safety of its own people. And so they are willing to send young men to the front lines. They've done it before. They are willing to use human shields. They've done it before. And so we have to operate in a way that acknowledges that harm and we should not be perpetuating it. And that just adds to the complexity of this situation.
Democratic Representative Anna Eskamani of Orlando is the first Iranian-American elected to the Florida legislature. She's not the only one navigating the developments on a professional and personal level. Houman Sadri is associate professor of international relations at UCF, who was born in Iran and studied the region for decades.
This conflict has a lot of different dimensions. It has our dimension in terms of, you know, trying to deal with one of the so-called rogue state that we've been dealing with. And we attacked Iran, not during the time of its maximum strength, but also at the time of its maximum weakness, you know. And we have taken away a lot of the targets which were easily available, like, you know, the Iranian Navy's gone, the Air Force was pretty much gone. We have bombed several times the nuclear sites. Right now, the president is pushing for getting Iran to, you know, basically open up Strait of Hormuz. And, you know, to the best of my knowledge, Strait of Hormuz is not closed. It's closed to U.S., Israel, and their regional allies, but it's completely open. Iranians are still exporting oil. In fact, they're exporting oil at the new price because they're not producing as much, you know, oil as they used to during the previous administrations in Iran, but they are selling it, you know, a lot more than ever before. And then most of their very close great powers are enjoying it. Russia, this is basically the war in that part of the world, is a gift to Russia. That's put the focus somewhere else, and Russians are doing whatever they want to do. The Chinese, who are really dependent on the oil from Persian Gulf, have diversified their oil, you know, imports, but they still have a very cozy relationship with Iran. They've given Iran some of the most sophisticated weapons, which we should be careful because there are some, you know, anti-ship missiles and everything else that we cannot get too close to their shores.
The U.S.-Israeli strikes on Iran happened about 40 days ago now, February 28th, that killed the Iranian supreme leader. Is this developing the way you thought it might to this point?
We were hoping that when the supreme leader is gone, a new generation comes over there that are more pragmatic. In Iran, there has always been a rivalry between more moderate forces and more ideological and radical forces. And it seems like the first layer that went away gave up to a second layer that was more radical and younger. The third layer is even younger and even more radical. So I would not define this in terms of improving the situation. And the only two people that I noticed that they have not been targeted yet is the foreign minister and also the Iranian president, Pezeshkian. They are both secular people. And I think it has been at the request of Pakistan and a couple of other allies that, look, we need somebody in Iran to negotiate with, you know, so at least keep those targets away because they're very easy to catch anyway, anytime they want to. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. But I'm not, you know, I'm usually very optimistic about life. You know, in this particular case, I'm not so optimistic.
Dr. Sadri, just outside of the politics of all of this, can you help me understand the impact to a regular, ordinary person living in Iran? What does life look like for them in the coming weeks?
That's a very good question. To the best of our knowledge and estimates that we have, somewhere between 75 to about 80% of Iranian population is actually anti-regime. Not once, not twice, many times they stood up to the regime. But these are civilian population that they don't have any weapons, you know. Iran is not U.S. that you can walk into Walmart and buy a gun for hunting purposes and then use it for other purposes. You see, that's not going to happen. So that type of population has been very selective in terms of pouring to the streets and, you know, resisting the government. But as you know, from December 15 of last year to the end of this past January, they were on the streets and they were hoping to get some help. And even the president was encouraging them and everything else and, you know, threatening the regime that, hey, do not, you know, kill people, et cetera, et cetera. But what happened? Again, the lowest estimate shows at least 30,000 people. The higher estimate show somewhere between 50 to 60,000 people were slaughtered, okay, in the streets. So if a regime is willing to do that to their own population, what do you think they're going to be doing to somebody who's going to attack them? And then you have to think about it from the perspective of the regime. I'm not saying you have to agree with them, but you have to think about it from their perspective. These guys, they have nowhere to go. Is that right? So when the revolution happened in Iran, the Shah of Iran, you know, still had a lot of other places to go. But these people, they have nowhere to go. So that was going to make him automatically the best possible soldiers to defend their cause, because they are fighting for their existence. This war is not for our existence, but it's certainly war for survival for the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is also personal for you. Can you talk to me about the family on your father's side and your connection to Iran? Do you remember being there or leaving?
Well, I was young when we left. You know, luckily, my father was able to convince the remaining family members who survived the revolution and the aftermath of the revolution to leave Iran. So I really don't have any relatives there. But through the international conference that I attend to represent UCF, I have met a number of Iranian professors, scholars, sometimes even business people, and even in certain events here and there, sometimes even ordinary people. I keep in touch with them through something like WhatsApp, but I have not heard from them on a regular basis. They usually try to send me short little messages that, hey, I'm okay, don't worry about me, because I see sometimes the result of some of the bombings. As you know, a number of residential areas have been attacked. One of the surprising part of it was Israel attacked a building that they thought is a building of one of the leaders of, you know, Revolutionary Guard leaders, and they actually destroyed a synagogue. People, they don't realize, but yes, majority of Iranians are Muslim and majority of the Muslims are Shiite, but Iran is a very multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-religious, you know, country in the Middle East. It's very different.
I know a month ago you were having trouble communicating with your friends in Iran, and from talking to you now, it's clear the communication challenges are still there. Do you know if they're safe as you and I are talking? Do you know if they're trying to get out?
To be very honest with you, I do not know. Okay. Every couple of days, they try to go somewhere that they find internet, and they send me very, very short messages. Don't worry, I'm okay. Or don't worry, we are okay. But it's not like my family in the States or in Europe that, you know, we are in touch by regular phone or text or, you know, Zooms or whatever. You know, that type of connection with those friends and colleagues in Iran doesn't exist now.
In terms of what's next, what does resolution even look like at this point?
I'm kind of surprised that president who has a wonderful TV experience, he's not just declaring victory and leave, you know, because he has got whatever he wanted to, you know, except those 400 to 500, I don't know, kilos of highly enriched uranium, and they're not going to give it away. Okay, he could maybe agree with them or provide them with some incentives that, look, we are not going to talk about change of regime, etc. So they feel secure and they would be willing to come to negotiation tables. We'll see. I do not know. I teach about foreign policy and diplomacy. You know, I don't teach military science. I don't teach how you can kill a human being in 27 different ways, you know. So I'm hoping that negotiation restarts, direct negotiation, not just sending messages. Also, I would hope that president stops sometimes exaggerating, because the Iranians know his messages, our allies know his messages, because they're also keep capping of things, and maybe he's gaining some support from certain segment of our population, but he's going to be losing face internationally, and I certainly do not want the president of the United States to ever lose that type of image overseas.
And what would you want people here to know about the situation in Iran?
The situation for Iran is very complex, because there is a regime over there that we cannot wait to get rid of. However, we cannot use all of the capabilities in our resources, because if we go for really bombing all these, you know, civilian, you know, facilities, then we are going to make the population that was against their own regime to rally around the flag. And is that what we wanted? No, that's not what we want. We want to weaken the regime and allow natural, you know, forces to take charge, so there would be maybe hopefully another revolution. So that would make it legitimate, because obviously every time U.S. went some part of the world and changed the leadership and put one of his own puppets over there, they immediately delegitimize the system. But hopefully that would be something that we want, that the regime is so weak that the people could stand up to it and then change it and really take the regime back into what it was supposed to be. 47 years ago, when revolution happened in Iran, it was not supposed to be a regime like that. They were changing from a monarchy to a republic, because in a republic, the presidents, they stay for only 4 years, and maybe they're given another 4-year term to make an impact. It's not like somebody stays over there forever and ever. But, you know, what happened was that revolution was hijacked, unfortunately, and we are still dealing with that. I'm hoping that the next change would be for better, not worse.
Bouman Sadri is Associate Professor of International Relations at UCF. There's more ahead on Engage. Governor DeSantis signed a law giving officials the power to designate certain groups as domestic terrorist organizations. Critics say it threatens free speech, but supporters say it's about public safety. We will break down what the law does and who may be affected. Subscribe to the Engage podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you don't miss an episode.
The Wrap is a podcast from Central Florida Public Media, curating the top Central Florida news stories and in-depth reporting each week. Join me, Brendan Byrne, as I bring you news headlines, deep reporting dives, and insightful conversations from the news team. A new episode of The Wrap every Friday morning. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. Ahead on the program, the astronauts on NASA's Artemis II mission are heading back to Earth, with some of the most critical parts of the mission happening tomorrow. But first, on Monday, Governor DeSantis signed HB 1471 into law. The bill creates a process for the state's chief of domestic security, the governor and his cabinet, to designate certain groups as terrorist organizations. It allows the state to restrict funding to organizations that receive the designation. At the bill signing in Tampa, the governor explained the motivation behind the bill.
You see different things. 9/11 obviously was, you know, a massive terrorist attack, but you also see it with somebody going in with like a suicide vest. You see it somebody going in and shooting people, you know, doing the chants. You know, that is kind of the formal, explicit jihad actions that we see that happens in the United States, when honestly it should never happen, because you shouldn't have people in this country who hate this country, and that's a big problem with immigration for many, many decades in this country. But you see that, and you see it around the world. But then you also have a more stealth version of jihad. And that is what we see in Europe, quite frankly. Massive migration of people into these Western European countries. They don't want to be like Western Europeans. They want to take their worldview and impose that in other lands. And part of that is, of course, the imposition of Sharia, but it also goes through a whole bunch of other things.
Governor DeSantis mentioned groups that his administration has previously tried to label as terrorist organizations on the state level.
Earlier this year, last year, we were strong in designating the Muslim Brotherhood as a foreign terrorist organization, designating the Council of American Islamic Relations as a foreign terrorist organization. And in fact, you know, CARE was an unindicted co-conspirator in the largest terror financing trial in American history, the Holy Land Foundation. So you see that, and okay, is that something that we want to be a part of? I mean, if there's a school that is allied with CARE, should you have any of your money going to things like that? I think not. And so part of what the legislature did in this bill was provide a statutory structure for the actions that we took earlier when we took those actions last year. It provided a process where we could identify groups that are foreign terrorist organizations.
The governor mentioned CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations. The nonprofit was founded in 1994 to advocate for the rights of American Muslims. The Florida chapter defends the region's Islamic communities against discrimination, works on policies to encourage inclusive communities, and promote youth programs. The governor's previous attempt to label CARE as a terrorist organization at the state level was blocked in court. Hiba Rahim, the interim executive director of CARE Florida, says there are two primary issues with HB 1471.
The first is the executive order. And the executive order was a unilateral declaration by the governor in December, where he labeled CARE as a terrorist organization. At that time, he had no legal authority to do so. There was no legislation that would have given him that type of authority. And we called him out on that. And his response then was, we're taking care of that. He responded immediately that there were things happening already that would take care of that, which raises a serious flag, suggesting that the executive office is working with the legislative office, which is an erosion of the separation of powers, because the executive branch should not be drafting the legislation, and the executive branch similarly should not be controlling the judicial branch. And so here there is this erosion of separation of powers, and that's why I have said that Governor DeSantis will go down as the governor who was the worst governor at eroding the democratic principles of the state. We have systems in place. The country has systems in place, even for a federal, for a terrorist designation. That's a federal responsibility. And there are lots of checks and balances in place. There are many agencies, almost two dozen agencies, that this has to clear through before a terrorism designation is made. Now, we are taking that from the federal level to the state level. We're taking the power of designation from many agencies to the hands of five individuals who can, if they deem that an organization fits a particular criteria, then they can give that label, and then you are guilty and then have to prove your innocence. It's the exact reversal of what due process is.
I'm also hearing you say this is giving too much power to just too few people.
This essentially creates a police state in Florida. It gives an unprecedented amount of power to a very few number of individuals. And it's worthy of note that these five individuals are the governor himself, his three cabinet members, currently two of three of whom are appointed by him, and the head of the FDLE, who is also appointed by him. Well, what does that tell you about how this is going to be abused? It is very clear that this will be abused, and it could be abused both ways. It could be abused against the left, could be abused against civil rights organizations with a right-leaning government. And in the future, if we have a left-leaning government, it could be abused against groups like the NRA, who could be accused of terrorism because the criteria is that they must sway political opinion. That's one set of criteria. And one of the points in the second set of criteria is that they harm or endanger life through killing, murder, or kidnapping, and a list of things. Well, it could be argued either way. And this will come back to haunt organizations. And this will be one of those laws that in the future, legislators will look back at and regret voting for.
So we're talking about constitutional limits and infringing on free speech and due process. Does the framing of this law create a hostile environment towards Muslims in Florida?
This law is being framed as an anti-Sharia law. That is deceiving and misleading, and it's essentially a lie. What happened was that there was anti-Sharia legislation. And I'm going to pause really quickly and just talk about the nonsensical nature of that legislation in itself. There is no effort in Florida or in the United States among American Muslims to bring Sharia into this country. In fact, Sharia means law, like Islamic law. And Islamic law teaches that you must abide by the law of the land that you live in if you are practicing as a Muslim. And so there is no intention to bring Sharia and impose it on the masses. That's such a ridiculous notion. It's comical. In fact, before it became so serious in legislation, the Muslim community was laughing about the assertion that we were hearing from elected officials. It is political theater. They are using this boogeyman expression like the Muslims are coming, Sharia is coming. There is no Sharia is coming. No one from the people to the pulpit is talking about bringing Sharia to America. That's the first thing. I should also note that many Muslims have now learned what Sharia means. I've been a part of many conversations in Muslim social settings where people are asking, like, what is Sharia? Like, they're asking their imams, their religious scholars, they're asking each other, guys, like, okay, what is Sharia? They're talking about Sharia. What exactly is Sharia? I'd heard that over a dozen times in the last few months. So that's how preposterous these comments are. Now, where does Sharia apply into the lives of American Muslim? That's my ability to wear my headscarf, my hijab. That's my responsibility to pray five times a day. That's my, similar to the Ten Commandments, teachings to be good to my neighbor, to love my parents, to be a good citizen in general. These concepts are deeply embedded into Sharia. These are the principles that I live my life through. I fast during Ramadan. That's part of Sharia. No one's going to force someone else to pray or fast or cover. Again, it is so preposterous that if people just stop and think about it, they'll realize that this doesn't even make sense. That ridiculousness is elevated by the understanding that the Establishment Clause and the Supremacy Clause in the United States already do not allow for any foreign religious law to supersede the Constitution. Those protections already exist. So now tell me, what is this really about? Now I'll give you the answer. The 28-page bill, HB 1471, has about one page talking about religious law and one sentence mentioning Sharia. It was interjected into this draconian bill to mask it as an anti-Sharia piece of legislation so that it could pass through legislature, so that they could pitch it as anti-Sharia, so that they could garner support around it. But in fact, it creates this police state where five individuals have the authority to issue terrorism designations. And in that authority, it allows them to bypass due process, to silence free speech, to make somebody guilty, and then force them to prove their innocence if and only if they have the means to challenge it in court. Everybody knows how expensive going to court is. So if you try to silence a student, think of all the students and the student protests. Protesting has been a part of student life in the United States forever, and certainly for the decades of our lifetime, from the Vietnam War till today. And if you designate an organization, a student organization, as a terrorist organization, the government will essentially shut it down completely. It will lead to the immediate expulsion of students. It will lead to the immediate canceling of funds, government funds, like scholarships, things like that. So it is very much an anti-free speech law, and it will certainly have a chilling effect on organizations from civil rights to student groups to, as I mentioned earlier, the far right, when their turn will come to be infiltrated.
How have care operations and community outreach changed since this declaration? And do you expect changes now that DeSantis has signed it into law?
We don't expect to be designated because we do not fit the criteria outlined for a terrorist designation. If the government comes after CARE with any type of bogus claims, that unfortunately, because of the second bill that was signed into law, which is the Secret Evidence Act, could be shielded. The evidence could be labeled as classified and shielded from the public's eye. That is a complete violation of the Sunshine Laws. And unfortunately, that passed as well. So You asked about expectation. We don't expect to be designated because we don't meet the criteria. If we are designated, then it will certainly confirm the assertion that some have made that these are very agenda-driven bills, as I mentioned, partially authored by DeSantis's office. And if they're agenda-driven bills, then we have still a judicial system that we will rely on as our last shield of defense to protect us based on the Constitution.
Hiba Rahim is the interim executive director of CARE Florida. The bill was sponsored by State Representative Hillary Cassell, a Republican representing parts of Broward County. We invited Cassell to join Engage to talk about the bill. She declined. Coming up, a crewed journey to the far side of the moon launched from our space coast. Now we're watching the high-stakes race home for Artemis II. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
There's a lot going on in space, from efforts to land astronauts on the moon
and liftoff of Artemis 1
to answering the age-old question, are we alone in the universe?
Wouldn't you want to know if there was life on another planet?
Are We There Yet? Explores space exploration every Tuesday at 6:30 here on Central Florida Public Media.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. As we're speaking, the astronauts on NASA's Artemis II mission are heading back to Earth from their journey around the moon. They traveled farther than any other humans have before. Some of the most critical parts of this mission are happening tomorrow. Central Florida Public Media Assistant News Director Brendan Byrne hosts the space exploration podcast, Are We There Yet?, and joins Engage Now. Thanks for being here, Brendan.
Thanks for having me, Sharon.
So talk to me. What's the plan here?
Yeah, so the four astronaut crew of the Artemis II mission are making their way home after, as you mentioned, a record-breaking trip around the moon. They are making this quarter of a million mile journey coming to an end tomorrow. But keep in mind, this is a test flight of the Orion spacecraft, and they will continue to perform flight tests on the vehicle as it makes its trip home. That includes this re-entry into the atmosphere. What's going to happen on Friday is the Orion space capsule will make some adjustments to a trajectory, and then it will punch through the atmosphere on Friday. It's going to be hitting speeds of around 24,000 miles per hour, enduring temperatures of up to 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And as it makes this trip down to splash down the Pacific Ocean, a series of parachutes will open, slowing the vehicle down to just 20 miles per hour as it splashes down just off the coast of San Diego, where there is a U.S. Department of War ship waiting to recover the astronauts from the capsule.
I want to know more about this re-entry on Friday and why the spacecraft has to come in just so fast.
Yeah, it's going really, really fast to begin with, right, in order to get around the moon and back. So, you know, coming into the atmosphere is always a very, very dynamic event for any spacecraft. But because this essentially the orbit around the Earth was so, so very high enough where it intercepted the moon, right, a quarter of a million miles, it's going to be slamming in really fast. So yeah, this is a very, very critical part of the mission, right? Not only is this reentry is a very dynamic environment, but you know, crew safety is very important here. There is risk to reentry, as we have seen before. Here's what mission pilot Victor Glover had to say about the importance of this part of the mission.
I've actually been thinking about entry since April 3rd, 2023, when we got assigned to this mission. And one of the first press conferences, we were asked, what are we looking forward to? And I said, splashdown. And it's kind of humorous, but it's literal as well, that we have to get back. There's so much data that you've seen already, but all the good stuff is coming back with us. There's so many more pictures, so many more stories. And I haven't even begun to process what we've been through.
Brendan, protecting the astronauts from the heat of reentry seems obviously critical. How is the capsule equipped to do that?
Yeah, so the capsule has a heat shield underneath it, around the bottom portion of the capsule as it hits the atmosphere. This is made of a material that the term is ablates. So essentially, as it gets hotter and hotter, it burns off, taking a lot of that heat and energy away from the spacecraft. This is technology that we used back in the Mercury days, right? When our first astronauts went to space and came back home, you use a heat shield. There are a bit of things that raise a few concerns about the heat shield, right? One is the heat shield has been tucked beneath the service module of the vehicle. So if you look at Orion, there's that conical capsule and then the cylinder underneath it that has a bunch of engines, and it's where the solar arrays are attached. The heat shield is in between those two things, right? And they haven't been able to look at the heat shield to see if it actually survived ascent, getting to space. It won't be exposed until that service module is jettisoned just before reentry. And during the Artemis 1 mission, the Orion space capsule had a very similar heat shield. And during reentry, they noticed that there was some changes that they didn't quite like to the heat shield. It took a little more destruction than they had planned for, and they're trying to figure out what happened there. So in order to kind of mitigate some of the risks that the Artemis 1 reentry went through, the Artemis 2 will be going straight through the atmosphere, right? Artemis 1 did something called a skip, where it kind of moved up and down through the atmosphere that kind of ablated a lot longer that heat, but it left it in that dynamic environment for a longer time. So NASA said with the Artemis 2 mission, they're just going to go straight down and keep that heat shield from being in that environment for as long as Artemis 1, and hopefully that will mitigate some of those risks. Now, this is a risky part. NASA has done the math. They have done the assessment of it, and they feel confident in the heat shield with this reentry. But this is always a very, very scary part of a mission. And, even Jared Isaacman, the administrator of NASA, said, he will not breathe a sigh of relief until the crew is under chutes, meaning those three parachutes have opened to help drop them and bring them back home. So this is critical, but there is technology to protect the astronauts from this really, really hot and fast environment that they will be going through.
Has this mission been a success so far?
Oh yeah. So far, this mission has been very successful. They met most of their objectives. I think there is only a very few that they skipped on doing just because they had enough data on what was going on. I think for us in the public, we saw some really incredible images that change our own perspective of where we are in the solar system and the universe, right? We're looking at that Earth set image that came down and seeing images of the moon and then seeing images from this eclipse that was seen from space is really incredible. This is a test flight, first and foremost. And Orion was really put through the test on this one, right? It's a very dynamic environment. It's the first time crew have been on it, the first time they're testing the life support system. And really, this sets up the next missions, the Artemis 3 and beyond missions, Artemis 4 taking humans to the surface of the moon. Speaking with media just before preparing for reentry, here's what mission specialist Christina Cook said about how this flight will help future flights.
Both in the vehicle and all in the last 3 years, we've really just worked to make sure that they are set up for success. And that's all of the teams, not just the crew, but the flight control teams, the mission engineering rooms, the launch teams, everyone. We've done our best to bring folks together and to make sure that we can be the best they can be.
She stressed that she hopes people forget about Artemis 2. She knows that there are bigger things to come thanks to this mission's success. The crew described the Artemis program as a relay. They even had a relay baton in the capsule to signify that, they are just the first leg of this long journey, and what they are doing is kind of setting up what more incredible things are to come from Artemis and from NASA.
Okay, so what does this mean for the mission overall, Brendan?
Yeah, so aside from these kind of critical tests of the Orion spacecraft, we learned a lot about the lunar surface and specifically the far side. The crew saw the far side of the moon from a vantage point that no other human beings had ever seen before, something like 4,000 miles away from the surface, giving it the entire perspective of the lunar surface, and took thousands of photos and took observations using their eyes. They were able to see changes in color on the surface of the moon, which indicate different minerals that the moon is made of, and essentially, get a better understanding of our moon. And why that is so important, Sharon, is our moon has been described as a witness plate, right? It has been out in our solar system for so long that things have been slamming into it left and right. You know, in fact, the Artemis astronauts watched impacts happen in real time, you know, a handful of impacts of asteroids and meteors hitting the surface of the moon. That shows us what has gone on in our solar system for the entire time we have been around here. So understanding our moon helps us better understand not only our place in the solar system and the universe, but where we came from. And that data that they collected answers a key part of that question of who we are in the universe.
Central Florida Public Media Assistant News Director Brendan Byrne hosts the Are We There Yet podcast. Brendan, thank you.
Thank you, Sharon.
That's all for this week's edition of Engage. I do want to invite you to our next event, Engage in the Community Redistricting. Voting maps are usually redrawn every 10 years, but Florida leaders say now is the time to redraw them. But some question whether changing the maps mid-decade is fair or even legal. Join us for a community conversation Thursday, April 16th at the Osceola Council on Aging. Hear from experts, share your voice, and see how district lines shape your community. We hope to see you there next Thursday at 6 p.m. I'm Sharon Stone. Thank you for the company. NPR News is next.